Am I saying that correctly? Very good. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court, Attorney Stephen Zaleski, I represent Jeffrey Lepsch in this case. This appeal presents, in my view, perhaps the most important feature in our legal system, the right to be tried by an impartial jury, certainly a right that's guaranteed everyone under the federal constitution and the state constitution. In this case, the jury consisted of 12 people plus one alternate who were picked from a panel of 65 people. Of those 12 jurors, four jurors in the pretrial questionnaires expressed the belief or opinion that Mr. Lepsch was guilty. Of those four, three expressed feelings that their mind was made up. Seven expressed a belief that law enforcement witnesses were more credible than non-law enforcement witnesses. And one juror expressed the belief that presumption of innocence should not apply in every case. In some cases, there should be a presumption of guilt. And also that...
As you're giving this recitation, counsel, are you reciting answers from their plea questionnaires, or are you reciting answers from their voir dire?
Well, both, Justice. Certainly from their plea questionnaire, that sets forth the basis, but is also discussed in voir dire.
Okay. Do you think it's important or not important that we make a distinction between the two, and why or why not?
Well, I think it's a distinction in terms of what the prospective jurors did to purge themselves of any bias that they had. I don't think it makes a distinction in terms of the trigger for the bias, because the problem is, in order to be impartial, the juror needs to swear. They need to make a swearing that they can set aside the bias and decide the case solely on the evidence. There would be no swearing with respect to the questionnaire itself, but the questionnaire itself certainly would reflect the actual bias exhibited by the juror.
I thought they were declared under oath, that when you signed the jury questionnaire, it was done under oath. Is that not true?
Judge, that is not true.
Okay.
From the face of the questionnaire, Judge, you are absolutely correct. It does say that.
Right.
It says that it's signed under the penalty of perjury.
Uh-huh.
That's an important question, Justice, because of this. To be charged with perjury in Wisconsin, there's a specific set of criteria. The perjury statute would require, first of all, that a person actually make the statement under oath, that they need to be administered an oath, they need to respond to the oath or the affirmation. So in this case, the questionnaire was not signed under oath or under affirmation, simply because there was no officer who rendered an oath or an affirmation to the person who signed it. And then secondly, under the perjury statute, perjury only applies to a verbal statements. It only applies to verbal statements. You cannot be prosecuted for a written statement. So at most, Justice, I think your question would perhaps implicate a false swearing, which would be a different statute. I think that's 946.31 or 33. And even under that statute, Justice, that would not apply, because that statute also requires that the person making the statement needs to do so under oath. There needs to be an administration by some official regarding an oath or an affirmation. So just because at the end of the questionnaire it has that language, that really is meaningless for purposes of the purge in the
Thank you.
Counsel, what is our standard of review with respect to subjective bias?
What is the standard review?
Standard of review.
The standard of review, Justice, would be that you're looking to see if the trial court's findings were clearly erroneous.
And when we look at the trial court's findings, what kind of information should we be accounting for?
What type of information should you be looking for?
Right. So, I mean, part of the reason that we do a clearly erroneous standard of review is because a fair amount of this is based on the trial court's live impression of credibility, right? So what we have before us is a paper record of what was said. Shouldn't we give some credence to what the trial court saw, what he heard, the tone of voice, the cadence of the response, those sorts of things?
Judge, you should. You should absolutely consider those things. The most important thing would be the transcript regarding what the prospective juror said during voir dire. That would be the most important thing, what the juror said. To the justice's point, absolutely, the court, under both Sixth Amendment law and our state law, courts should look at demeanor, look at maybe character as it's set forth in a biographical data, the personality that's coming through.
Right. So as we look at some of these responses, where you are suggesting that we require an unequivocal response to an inquiry, and you point to some of the responses as being inadequate. So, for example, if a juror were to respond to, can you set aside your preconceived notions, and the juror's answer is, I think so, you find fault for that, because it's not an unequivocal statement. But doesn't the question of whether it's equivocal or not depend on how it was said?
Judge, perhaps my primary concern is not with the jurors who gave language such as "I'll try," "I'll do my best." I would address that. My primary concern is with respect to the jurors who did not, in any way, shape, or form, say anything to the extent that they would set aside their belief or opinion, and that they would decide the case on the evidence. So I think we need to look at the transcript, and that would be the starting point. Because I do agree that when we get to the point where we're looking at prospective jurors who use language like "I'll try," "I think I can," then we get into issues such as what the justice is suggesting. We get into the intonation of the voice, inflection, whether the person's looking you in the eye, their demeanor. That's really not the essence of my complaint with respect to the particular jurors here, specifically John A. and Derek M. Those prospective jurors, those jurors did not make any statements, Justice, that they could set aside their belief and opinion, that they could decide the case on the evidence. During voir dire, that never came up at all, neither the trial court, defense counsel, or the prosecutor. No one asked them any question regarding their ability to set aside their belief regarding the credibility of law enforcement. So, yes, I would agree with you. You can look at the transcript. That's the record. That's very important. There are things not in the transcript where we need to defer to the trial court. That's absolutely true. That's in Patton. That's in the Seventh Circuit law. That's clearly in our law. But I don't think we even get to that point, Justice, because some of the jurors in this case were so woefully deficient in what they said, we don't even get to the nuances.
And you would point to John A. and Derek M. as the most egregious examples?
Of that, yes, Judge, simply because they made no statements during voir dire as to their ability to set aside their beliefs. Correct, and decide the case on the evidence, and there's no finding by the trial court that they were believable in that regard.
Well, what exactly did John A. say that you're objecting to?
Well, both John A. and Derek M. expressed the belief that law enforcement officers would be more credible than non-law enforcement officers.
That's all they said, never said anything else?
Well, what John A. did indicate additional things in his questionnaire. John A. presented with a multiple layer of bias. John A., in fact, also took the position that Lepsch was guilty and his mind was made up. So John A. presented with a multiple layer of bias. And I would say John A. was bored-eyed regarding his belief in Lepsch's guilt and that his mind was made up. That did come out on bored-eyed. But he was not bored-eyed on his belief regarding law enforcement being more credible than non-law enforcement.
And Derek M., is that all he said?
Derek M., yes, was the same thing. Derek M. expressed the belief regarding law enforcement. But they did go a bit further than that. It wasn't simply an abstract belief. Both Derek M. and John A. Indicated that they had friends who were law enforcement officers. That there was, at least with respect to, I think it was Derek M., he indicated that he had a job at an airport. He came into contact with law enforcement officers, and he responded that he had a deep connection. So,
was there a contest between the credibility of a law enforcement officer about a fact and the credibility of other witnesses about that fact, that you focus on this part of the voir dire or lack thereof?
Yes, Judge. Two reasons. One, just the sheer number of law enforcement witnesses in the case. There are 31 called by the state. I believe 13 were law enforcement. But more pointedly to the court's question, in this case, there was a significant evidentiary issue at trial that that involved the credibility of law enforcement, and that is this. After the offense occurred, law enforcement came out to investigate. They obtained surveillance footage from various businesses. I believe they got footage from a bank, which showed a person walking towards a camera store, and then the person coming out of the camera store, and they placed them going there at 1 o'clock, maybe coming out at around 3, and law enforcement took the position that that was Lepsch. But law enforcement, in investigating the case, also spoke with witnesses, and they received information from one witness that placed, who said that they saw a person inside the store at around 4:15. And that potentially at trial gave Lepsch an alternate suspect that helped him in his defense. Well, law enforcement did obtain surveillance footage of a different business, which captured the front of the camera store, I believe, from 1:30 to 5:30. The investigator from the Department of Criminal Justice went to that store to review the footage. He reviewed it, but he did not collect the footage, which is an important factor. He did not collect it. So I think 2 weeks later, he goes back to collect the footage and discovers that because of some glitch, a relevant time period had not been collected. So that particular footage only contained the time period 1:30 to 3:30. So the time where this alternate suspect, as reported by the witness, would have been in the store was not recovered. That was lost. So the state at trial addressed the issue by calling the investigator who reviewed that tape. And he addressed it by saying, well, I've reviewed it, and I did not see any person enter the store or leave the store at 4:15. That didn't happen. And so it was a material issue, and certainly we get into issues of credibility. Some people may take that as face value. They may believe the investigator from the Department of Criminal Investigations. Some people may find that very suspicious in this day and age where you have a lot investigator like that going into a small community and developing evidence on a big murder case and taking the position that he did. Some people would find that very self-serving and suspicious. So at a minimum, credibility was an issue.
Thank you. Well, isn't your key argument here, you've given us the facts of these two whom you consider the most egregious, as I understand it. And my question to you is, okay, doesn't what happened here fit the Wisconsin standard for allowing the juror to sit and say he/she was not biased, subjectively, objectively? And aren't you really asking the court to adopt a different standard in Wisconsin that would fit the Seventh Circuit standard?
Well, Justice, I do reference the Sixth Amendment. I would ask the court to do that. But I think even if the court wanted to take a very narrow view of things, if the court wanted to simply apply Wisconsin law, the court would still have to reverse the case. And I say that I say that because of this. I'm looking at State versus Carter, and that case tells us that when you have a prospective juror who openly admits bias, he's not examined about that bias, that prospective juror is subjectively biased as a matter of law. And that is what we have here with respect to Derek M. and John A. There was a bias admitted to, and that bias went unexamined, unvoir dired, and then they sat. So the case is very similar to State v. Carter. Even on the most narrow grounds, even if the court were to totally ignore what I argue with respect to the Sixth Amendment, the case would still have to get reversed under State v. Carter.
What language from State v. Carter are you relying on?
Judge, I believe the statement I just made is an express quote from a State v. Carter where a juror openly admits a bias and is not questioned regarding that bias. The juror is subjectively biased as a matter of law. And I think, Judge, also, I think a court could take a very narrow view of some other jurors under the Foucher case in terms of whether they would be considered objectively biased. I think perhaps the last sentence of the Foucher case is very instructive. I think in that case, you had a prospective juror who knew one of the witnesses. The witness was his neighbor, and he indicated that he thought that person was a person of great integrity who wouldn't lie. And ultimately, the trial court found that particular juror was not subjectively biased because that juror said, I think I can set that aside. And the trial court was satisfied with that. That came up to this very court, and the court said, no, that's not enough. We find objective bias because based on the strength of this person's views, even though he could set that aside, we're going to find objective bias. And I would argue that with respect to the jurors who indicated they thought Leps was guilty and their minds were made up, they fell into that category. I would submit, Justice, that if your mind is made up on something, that's more pronounced than having a strong view. So if the prospective juror in Foucher had strong views regarding the credibility of his neighbor who was going to be a witness, and he was struck from being objectively biased, the jurors in this case who rendered the opinion that their minds were made up, they were even more objectively biased.
Counsel, I want to just interject where we started the conversation, and that is just so I know that I'm following your train of thought. Are you talking about the pretrial questionnaires that were sent out, or are you blending those responses with the voir dire responses? Because what I'm kind of hearing, and I want to give you the chance to clear it up for me if I'm mistaken, what I'm kind of hearing is a blending of the two, although there's a register of concern in regard to the two named jurors. I hear you in your responses to my colleagues' questions kind of, I think, blending the two responses, and it seems to me that there's a distinction to be made between where someone starts out, because what you might refer to as bias, I might refer to as a lack of knowledge, for instance, and that's part of what the voir dire process is about, is educating potential jurors, and then testing and determining and giving them the opportunity to tell the court and the parties and the lawyers whether they will commit to, once having learned what the rules are, whether they will commit to following them. So do you follow my question?
I think I do, Justice.
Okay.
I would say this, and it's a little confusing because I do draw a distinction between the jurors that I'm arguing about. So
the two, the John
yes,
and
yes.
Derek?
So just with Derek M. and John A., I'm only concerned about what they stated in their jury questionnaires.
Okay.
Okay, and I'm concerned about that because they were not voir dire regarding what they said in the questionnaire regarding their view regarding the credibility of police officers. So that didn't come up in the voir dire, so I really can't blend that. So we're specifically talking about their view in the questionnaire, and it's so problematic because they were not voir dire. But, Justice, I do, when I talk about the other jurors who expressed the view that Lepsch was guilty, their mind was made up, okay, that was in the questionnaire, but that was also discussed at voir dire.
Yes.
So I do blend my complaints about what they said between their voir dire and their questionnaire.
Okay, but you can see where that might be problematic for future cases where a potential juror, you know, I'm concerned about the parties in this case, of course, but I'm equally as concerned about all the parties to come in all the similar cases that this case will be used to instruct our trial courts and the attorneys and interested citizens. And my point being that an average citizen, unlearned in the law, might not, for instance, be aware of the legal presumption of innocence, that a citizen who charges against whom have been brought by the state enjoys the legal presumption of innocence up till if and when the state may overcome that presumption of innocence by evidence which is beyond a reasonable doubt. And so if someone, I guess my response to your lack of a distinction between the two would be, well, what about that juror and who comes to court unaware of such a legal principle, but then upon learning that and being instructed by the court that is the law, and then who acknowledges that is the law and then commits in the proper fashion, whether, as Justice Abrahamson pointed out, it's the Wisconsin framework or it's the new case that you seem to be kind of backing off or at least not really hanging your hat on, commits sufficiently to following, well, then why should we hold that person to their unknowing response in the pretrial questionnaire?
Well, I believe they would have to be voir dire on it. They would have to be. I would agree with the court that even if they exhibit a belief or an opinion which on its face could initially be problematic, they could certainly cleanse themselves of any taint and end up sitting on the jury.
So
if it came up during the voir dire that they stated that they could set aside their belief and set aside any opinion, decide the case on the evidence.
So for clarity's sake, are you asking us then to focus on our analysis, whether it's the Wisconsin framework or the Seventh Circuit case, are you asking us to focus on the two, the John A. and the Derek R.?
I would ask the court to focus on those, yes, because those are the most blatant example, yes. Okay. Absolutely. I think the significance in this case is you had so many problematic jurors that this could take a lot of time, and I was really constrained by the brief. But the clearest examples of the problems are Derek M. and John A., because they weren't word R at all regarding their beliefs regarding the credibility of the law offers.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Schaefer, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin. Excuse me, I'm nervous. Not one single juror who sat on this case was biased. Not seven, not two, not one juror was biased, and it is Mr. Lesch's burden on appeal to prove otherwise. But it's important for this court to note, before it even gets to bias, it needs to remember that it is deciding this issue under the rubric of ineffective assistance of counsel. Was counsel ineffective in the jury selection process? For the deficiency prong, then the question is, was counsel deficient in his strategy and not questioning the jurors further or moving to strike them for cause? And we know they're not because of the Mockner hearing. And if you haven't read the entire Mockner hearing, I really encourage you to do so. It is the gold standard of Mockner hearings. The DA, Mr. Zaleski, the attorney, Mr. Lepsch's attorney was questioned. It is a fabulous Mockner hearing where they get to the trial strategy of Mr. Lepsch's counsel.
Counsel, have you conceded the prejudice prong of the Strickland inquiry? I'm looking at page 39 of your brief, in which you say, a lawyer's failure to act to remove a biased juror who ultimately sat on the jury constitutes deficient performance resulting in prejudice to his or her clients.
I'm not conceding that there was no prejudice. My point is that I want this court to focus on deficient performance. I know a lot of times the state attorney comes in and they have a brief and it's easy to prove prejudice or to disprove that there was prejudice because you can say, well, even assuming there was deficient performance, there was no prejudice. In order for him to show prejudice, he would have had to show that the trial counsel would have had to question the jurors further and that those jurors would have resulted in, you know, actual bias. But I would like this court to talk about deficient performance because I don't think these attorneys were deficient at all, and neither did the post-conviction court who was there, and neither did the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Zaleski makes an interesting argument that if counsel does not challenge a potentially biased juror, and that juror goes on to sit on the case, that is a structural problem. And that without consulting with his client before allowing that biased juror to sit, that he's been deprived of the Sixth Amendment rights. And that's not a legitimate trial strategy.
I would agree that if there was a biased juror that sat on this jury, that would be a structural error. There was no biased juror that sat on this jury.
All right, so let's concentrate on that then. So John A. and Derek M. say that they, in so many words, say that they would give more credibility to police officers' testimony.
Yes.
That was not inquired into in voir dire.
That's correct.
And so tell me why that would not constitute a not impartial juror.
Just to back up, I do want to stress that it was, if counsel had believed that those jurors were biased, then it was counsel's duty then to question them, and it's not an issue of whether the court was should have interjected, because the court was not made aware that Mr. Letch thought that the jurors were biased. I'm sorry, could you
repeat? Well, yeah. So can you explain to me why? Because we're reviewing this on a clearly erroneous standard.
Right.
So we need to look at these two jurors and say, was the trial court wrong, clearly and erroneous, clearly wrong, in concluding that they were impartial. So give me your best argument on why you believe that these two, John A. and Derek M., were impartial.
Okay, for a couple reasons. Number one, the statement, so we get this clear, this is what they said. This is what was not asked at voir dire. You will be hearing, this is from the voir dire question that he takes issue with. You will be hearing testimony from several police officers in this case. Do you think you would give police officers more credibility, less credibility, or the same amount of credibility as other witnesses who were not police officers? And just to be sure, both John A. and Derek said more credibility. The reason that this does not indicate bias for a few reasons. Number one, this is a very generic question. It's not going to any specific officers in this case. It's not saying that I'm going to hold these specific officers in this case, I'm going to give them more credibility, and I'm not going to give credibility to this specific defendant. The other thing is exactly what Justice Abrahamson asked, is this all we have? This is not all we have from these two jurors. Both of the jurors said, do you have a problem with the legal proposition that a defendant must be presumed innocent unless and until the prosecution can prove he is guilty? They both said no. All the jurors.
But that doesn't go to the credibility question.
Okay.
Right. So what do we have that responds to their assertion that they would give police officers' testimony greater credibility? And I'm asking in the context of this. If they would, if those statements went unremedied, unexplored, would a juror who would give a police officer more credibility than any other witness, would that be a biased juror?
I would think that if that was the question, but that's not this case. This case is just this one question, and we're dealing with this one question, this very generic question. If the question was, would you give this specific police officer in this case more credibility, then I think we might have more of an issue of an appearance of bias or maybe a potential of bias. But that wasn't the case. And at the Mockner hearing, it was asked by Mr. Zaleski, why did you not, especially with John A., why did you not ask? You know, you had this red light. Why did you not ask them about the police credibility? And John A. said, the theory of the defense that we intended to present was that we were asking the jurors to look at the evidence that was presented in the court in an objective manner. One of the things that Mr. A. said in the questionnaire is that he thought Mr. Letch was guilty, but that essentially he could be objective about viewing the evidence. And he asked, and you still think he could be objective? Yes. And why was that? I guess the fact that he wrote on the questionnaire that he could be objective. I thought, if he couldn't be objective, I would have moved to struck him for cause. With Derek M.
Well, let's just stop for a minute. I asked whether there was anything else other than the statement that I would attach more credibility to an officer. Now, what you read says that there's something else on the questionnaire that says he can be objective. What is it? What was the question on the questionnaire that you're referring to?
Question number 38. All the jurors, all nine jurors, right. Is there any reason that you cannot be impartial in this case? Every jury answered no. So what?
But it didn't. He may think he's totally impartial, but that he would believe a police officer more than anyone else. That may be to this juror impartiality.
I don't mean to parse words, but that's not what the questionnaire said, that they would believe police officers more than anybody else. It was,
well, what does the, what, again, read the two.
You will be hearing testimony from several police officers in this case. Do you think you would give police officers more credibility, less credibility, or the same amount of credibility as other witnesses who were not police officers?
So who would you believe more, an officer or a non-officer? Is that another way of stating that question?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Who would you believe more, an officer or a non-officer? Is that another way of stating that question?
I don't think so.
Okay, tell me why. And then you think it's cured, if I understand your argument, you think it's cured because they answered the question about impartiality.
I don't think that's the only cure. I think it's also cured because the defense counsel talks about his strategy at the Mockner hearing, and that if he would have thought these jurors were biased, he would have struck them for cause. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, the test isn't whether defense counsel thought they're biased. Isn't the test whether we think they're biased, objectively?
When you're reviewing the post-conviction court's decision, yes, correct.
Yeah. So defense counsel may have thought he's doing a great job because he doesn't think that's bias. But a court may think that's bias as a matter of law.
And that is why the court can look to basically, not just this one question in a vacuum.
That's right.
And that's why the defense was like, if I thought these jurors were biased, I would remove the cause, but I actually wanted them on my juror. I didn't think they were biased. And so the defense counsel is not, as he said, he's not hung up on this one thing. He testified, there were some negatives and there were some positives, but there were more positives that he thought he would stick with these jurors.
Do you think that the post-conviction decision was consistent with Patton in regard to how to determine whether or not bias was present?
I think this court follows Patton. I look at Patton next to Erickson, and the language is identical. How you can look to juror bias, how you can look to inflection, how the trial court is in the best position to judge bias, to judge impartiality. So I think that the post-conviction court, the Court of Appeals, I think this court has been consistent that we do follow Patton.
Okay. So you don't think we need to change our jurisprudence? I guess I had looked at Lindell, and I thought it was very similar to Patton, too. I think where the difference that's raised in the briefs are this, quote, unequivocal assurance.
Correct.
That you find coming out of Oswald.
Correct.
And I'm not sure that that's really different from what is said in Patton, but it's like a shorthand. And sometimes when courts try to do shorthands, all they do is create appealable issues. Do you think they're different? Oswald is different from Patton?
I think Judge Adelman's decision is definitely different.
Okay, and how do you think it's different?
Because I think Patton does not say you have to have unequivocal answers. It's saying just the opposite, like we do in Erickson. I mean, the juror that was moved to strike and for cause in Patton, his responses were, I guess I don't need more evidence. I think I can be partial. I mean, I'm summing it up. I think. And Patton said that's enough. And we have this cold record. We are going to defer to the trial counsel who was there, who could judge voice inflection and judge credibility. And so I think Patton and Erickson are synonymous with each other.
So you think the Seventh Circuit extended beyond Patton, and that we should stay with Patton and not the Seventh Circuit?
I do agree, and I think the Seventh Circuit case, they're focusing on the words that, a juror is impartial if he gives unequivocal assurances.
Mm-hmm. Is that language from Patton?
No. And no, that's how the Seventh Circuit is describing
Patton. What's the language?
That's not correct.
What's the language from Patton?
Patton. One of the questions, one of the tests and patents is the question is whether there is fair support in the record for the state's conclusion that the juries would be impartial. Other language in patent, it is here the federal court's deference must operate, for while the cold record arouses some concern, only the trial judge can tell which answers are said with the greatest comprehension and certainty. And so there's nothing that says that they have to have unequivocal answers.
I think they also say something about actually, the court says the challenged juror's testimony may be, quote, ambiguous and at times contradictory.
Right.
So
and ambiguous is synonymous with, right, you know, unequivocal. So, yeah, that's why I think Erickson and Patton, and that's why I agree with the Mika's brief, follow Patton. Well, we already do follow Patton. I don't think Erickson needs any clarification. I don't think this case law needs any clarification. We follow the U.S. Supreme Court case law.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court case, and I hope I'm reading, there was a long dissent here, and I shouldn't be reading from that. But it says that the question is whether the juror, did a juror swear that he could set aside any opinion he might hold decide the case on the evidence, and should the juror's protestation of impartiality have been believed? You think that's the test?
I think that is a test if we have a case like Patton where there was the defense counsel moved to strike for cause and there was a discussion and the juror wavered, and so then there is, and then that becomes the test. Could you set aside the opinion and hold the case and the evidence until the juror's protestation have been believed? We don't have a Patton case. I mean, I can't stress that enough. This is under an ineffective assistance of counsel case, and was he deficient? Was counsel deficient in the jury selection process? I don't even think we need to get to Patton, because I think this case can be cited on the deficient performance and prejudice that the Letch cannot meet.
Well, if we thought as a matter of law, though, that a juror was biased,
then
fall right out of ineffective assistance and back into Patton and Erickson.
I agree. That's correct. Yeah.
What role does the juror's oath play in your argument here today? And I'm referring to the oath not before voir dire, but once the jury is selected.
Oh, okay. So the jury was, so in this case, the oath was provided by the clerk in a jury room outside of the defendants, and the state wasn't there as well. Okay. So that's the context of your question, I'm assuming.
No.
Okay, go ahead then.
That's getting to another issue.
Okay.
I'm staying on the same issue. I mean, in Patton, there was the discussion about the oath that I'm referring to. I'll call it the second oath. And where the jurors swear that they can set aside any predilection, or they can set aside any opinion they may have held and decide the case based solely on the evidence presented.
Okay. And again, I think that would apply in a case if it was like Patton. If we had a case where a juror was moved to strike for cause, and then there was a discussion with the defense attorney and the prosecution and the trial judge, and then the move for cause, and then the trial court is in the position, you know, can the juror swear that he can set aside his beliefs, and can the trial, and is the trial court, can they believe the juror? So I think that's not a case that we have here, but that's where the oath comes in Patton, but I don't think it comes in here because we don't have that set of facts.
Counsel, if the claimed bias is a propensity to give a law enforcement officer more credibility, is that significant only when there is a contest between a law enforcement officer and a non-law enforcement officer about a particular fact? Let me shorten that up a little bit. So what I'm basically asking is, Is there room for a harmless error review here? If we were to say, well, generally speaking, when a juror says, I'll give greater credibility to a police officer, but if there's no real that there's no significant contest over a disputed fact between a police officer and a non-police officer, what does it matter?
I think that that is a question that that should be looked at, whether or not there's a dispute as to the officer's testimony or not. I guess I'm still having a...
Sure. So, so Mr. Zaleski has identified this issue with the videotape.
Yeah.
That there's a part of it missing. There's some testimony
sure.
that there may have been someone in the shop afterwards, and the police officer testifies, I looked at the video, I didn't see anything. Well, that doesn't necessarily directly contradict another witness. So is if the question is about bias, it's I as a juror, I give more credibility to police officers, but there's no real factual dispute where a police officer is on one side of the dispute and a non-police officer is on the other side. What's it matter if there's no contested testimony between those two types of witnesses?
I see a point where would it matter, but I don't think this is addressed under a harmless error test. This is addressed under ineffective assistance of counsel and deficiency and whether there was prejudice. So I don't think we addressed it under the harmless error aspect in this case.
Isn't prejudice the opposite coin of harmless error? If it's harmless, it's not prejudice. If it's prejudice, it's not harmless.
Well, this court has are separate tests. I do see the relations in, but I'm not going to say they're the same test.
Is this a generic questionnaire that goes to every criminal case, or every civil case, or is it designed for this case? That's another way of
right.
Asking the Justice Kelly's question.
That's not in the record. I do know the answer to this case.
Pardon me?
That information is not in the record. Okay.
All right. Then, okay. Then I don't want to know it. But my point of the question is, if it's a generic questionnaire, it would go to cases in which you didn't have a police officer testifying at all.
Sure.
At which point it would be just, you would ignore the question. Because sure. even if the guy said, I always trust the police officer, I never trust someone who disagrees with the police officer, it wouldn't matter in that case.
Sure.
Because there was no police officer.
Question. Yeah, I think that was Justice Kelly's point. Yes, I agree.
But here, the police officer did testify. The
yes.
police officer did testify. Then the next question is, was there contradictory testimony by a non-police officer?
There was no contradictory testimony.
No, but right. the question then is whether you believe this police
sure.
officer in his testimony.
Right, and that was for okay. the jury to decide, and they believed the police officer. Correct.
Yep. Now I have another question.
Okay.
Patton involved a habeas.
Yes.
And I always worry about habeas cases because the standard of review in a habeas corpus case from a state
yes.
conviction is different
yes.
than a state court reviewing it initially.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I do.
So if when we decide this case, we will decide it in a particular way. But when it goes up on habeas to the Seventh Circuit, they may use different standards.
They will. Correct. Yeah, they'll see, you know, whatever this, and I do probably suspect this will come up on habeas.
That's right.
And that's
so
why
do I.
Yes, right. And so as a lawyer that works in habeas, I really do want you to address both deficiency and prejudice, because on habeas, if you address both, they will, you know, review that under review and give deference to, you know.
And if you have just one juror who's a court finds is biased, the end. Right?
I agree.
Okay.
Right.
Counsel, I want to just spend a second on the question of some of the jurors' remarks that they had their minds made up. Chief Justice Marshall made a distinction in United States versus Burr between light impressions of the mind and on the one hand, and on the other, strong and deep impressions. Which category do these jurors belong in who initially said they had a preconceived idea of how the case ought to go?
I would suppose that it was initial, and then it was rehabilitated on voir dire, and then, you know, and they had also additional questions on the jury question, that there's not a concern with that because they were rehabilitated by the trial judge in this case.
All right, so that would belong in the light impressions that could be rehabilitated as opposed to the strong and deep impressions that couldn't.
Correct.
Well, maybe with the strong and deep, you just have to dig deeper and try harder. I don't know.
What do you think?
Could be.
How would they rehabilitate it?
Well, the judge... I'm going to check my brief here.
Tell me what page you're reading on so I can look at it, too.
Am I on page 17 in my brief, where I talk about the jurors who stated in their questionnaire that they had formed an opinion or made up their minds? Lisa Kay, I talk about how she was rehabilitated by the trial judge, and that's on page 18.
Well, how do you deal with the John A.?
And John A., I also, when asked by the court as to his ability to base the decision on the evidence heard in the courtroom, John A. relied on his experience as a past juror and replied, "I believe so. From my previous experience, I was able to." And he also...
Didn't he also make a statement along the lines of, based on his previous experience as a juror, he understood his obligations?
Yes, yes. And that and John A. also wrote on his questionnaire that he could be objective.
Now, this into John A. deals with an express opinion as to his guilt. What about his opinion as to finding the officers more credible than others?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
This goes to his saying that tentatively made up, or he had an opinion on guilt, but it doesn't deal with what we've narrowed in on, or the defendant has narrowed in terms of the credibility of the police officers. So where is he rehabilitated as to that?
On page 15 of my brief, I talk about John A., and I'm talking about the jurors who stated in their questionnaire that they believe police officers are more credible than other witnesses. At the Mockner hearing, just to answer your question directly, there was no voir dire on this issue.
Right.
But at the Mockner hearing, Lepsch's attorney noted that John also wrote that he could be impartial, and Lepsch's attorney testified that he thought he could be objective, and if he wasn't objective, he would have moved to strike him.
So the rehabilitation is that he could be impartial.
I'm sorry, there's also... The court did discuss... the court just discussed at voir dire. So you believe that you could listen to the evidence in the courtroom and you could make up your determinations based upon what you hear in the courtroom and not be sitting in there thinking, that's not what the paper said and what happened to that stuff, what the TV said. You know, you could put that out of your mind. And he said, "I believe so. Again, from my previous experience, I was able to." So that was the...
What page of the record are you...
That is on page 206, it's 206 of the subtle record, and page 86, lines 13 through 20.
Okay. And then you have on page 14 how Derek M. is rehabilitated.
Yeah, and that one... Mr. Zaleski did not ask John A., he's really concerned now about why he did, why he did not move to strike John A. or why he did not further question John A. He didn't ask about John A. at the Mockner hearing. He did ask about John M. And at the Mockner hearing, Lepsch's attorney explained his strategy in picking Mr. Lepsch. Why I didn't ask him about the police officer credibility issue was because he was someone that I thought might be favorable because he wrote on the questionnaire that he believes in facts and not in people. Again, keeping with the theme of objectivity rather than what people had or may not have come in with prior to the beginning of the evidence. And then he if that makes any sense. So, again, we have the, if you could review the Mockner hearing and read about the strategy that these three experienced public defenders had. They were not deficient in failing to ask further questions on this one issue in a vacuum, and counsel obviously cannot prove prejudice because he cannot prove, had there been further questioning, that these jurors were biased. That's all I have, unless there are further questions from the court.
Thank you very much.
It's clear from the voir dire transcript that these two particular jurors, John A. and Derek M., were not rehabilitated with respect to their views regarding the credibility of law enforcement. They were rehabilitated, certainly, with respect to their views on guilt and setting aside that, and that the mind was made up. They were not rehabilitated with respect to their view regarding the view about law enforcement.
Is that true, what she said? You didn't ask about John A. at the Mockner hearing?
The transcript speaks for itself. I asked about John A. and Derek M.
So you did ask about John?
Yes, yeah, I specifically did that. The transcript speaks for itself. I think to...
You're talking about the Mockner hearing.
The Mockner hearing, correct. The Mockner hearing speaks for itself. I think to get back to Justice Kelly's question regarding belief regarding law enforcement, there's significant case law on that out of the federal circuits. I cite, I believe, a case out of the Eighth Circuit in my brief. There's a case called Brown v. U.S. 338 F. Second 543, and that provides a good discussion. In a lot of federal cases, the judge is the one who conducts the voir dire. So the defense counsel and prosecutor will ask the judge to ask certain questions, and Brown indicates that, and it gets specifically to what Justice Kelly was getting at, where you have a case where police officer testimony is going to be very important in the case, it's not only appropriate, that question should be given if requested. And there's a continuing case law that describes, well, to what extent, if that's not done, is that reversible error? And it gets to be reversible error where, as Justice Kelly was suggesting, if credibility is a material issue, then that's reversible error. There could be a case where it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But
if it was such a case where the credibility was really not an issue, that would not be a reversible error.
Well, that would be a factor to consider. But in this case, the testimony of the law enforcement officer was put into question. He was cross-examined on that. He was cross-examined. There was no other witness who came up and took the stand and contradicted him, but he was cross-examined, so his credibility was placed in issue.
Excuse me, I thought, because I started asking about this line of questions a long time ago, and I thought you said that there was a witness who said they saw someone in the shop at 4 or 4:15.
Correct.
And if the witness says that and the officer testifies and says, I looked at the video during that period of time, I didn't see anyone, seems to me their testimony, if that's true, is in direct conflict. Then I just heard you say, well, there was no one that... So I'm not sure. What was there another witness that testified that he or she saw someone in the camera shop at 4 or 4:15?
Well, Justice, that particular witness was not called at trial.
Oh, well, then if it wasn't called at trial, it doesn't help the jury very much, right?
Well, that issue was presented before the jury via cross-examination. The investigator was cross-examined regarding law enforcement's discussions with another witness, that they had information. So it came before the jury on cross-examination.
So in cross-examination, the officer was asked, did someone come and tell you they saw, or did you talk with someone that said they saw a person in the shop at 4:15?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And he admitted that someone had come to talk to him at that time period, and then it was fleshed out more when he stated, well, I watched the video and I didn't see anybody.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And then to perhaps get back to Justice Gableman's comment about Patton. I don't think I'm backing off Patton in any regard. I don't intend to do that. I just mean to suggest that there are various avenues for the court to reverse the case. I think a Patton, it's a very easy analysis, but it's a very broad analysis. I think the court can reverse the case more narrowly on State v. Carter. That's the most narrow analysis, just simply on subjective bias. So I think Patton certainly controls, it's applicable. The state really loses under Patton, but I think the state loses under more a narrow analysis, subjective bias. With respect to Justice Abraham's question on the habeas corpus standard of review, that is correct. I would agree that Patton was a habeas corpus case. I don't believe that presents any sort of peculiar standard of review issue here, because the Patton test comes up in other cases before the Seventh Circuit.
My problem is I don't know what the Patton test is.
The Patton.
I don't know what the Patton test is. I want somebody to show me the language that says what the Patton test is, and that it would be applied in a non-habeas case.
Judge, the language is very simple. The juror needs to swear that he can set aside his belief or opinion and swear that he can decide the case on the evidence, and then the court needs to find that juror is believable. That's essentially the Patton standard. And that standard is embraced in all sorts of non-habeas corpus cases, both at the Seventh Circuit level. All the cases cited in my brief are I shouldn't say all of them, but a lot of them are non-habeas corpus. Moo Min before the Supreme Court was a non-habeas corpus. So it's a historical test. Did the jurors say this or not?
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Well, thank you both for very good arguments and also for very good briefs that make us scratch our head about how to put together all of the different witnesses and what the concerns are about each and every witness, so we can carefully look at them, which I can assure you we will. We will adjourn until 3:05 when we will reconvene in closed conference, but the court is adjourned for the day.